Go ahead and get started. I'm very excited to be having this conversation today with all of you. I'm with Joe Chi, who I'll introduce in a moment, to really introduce what we're calling the impact portfolio. Vista's impact portfolio, we believe, offers investors an opportunity to pursue environmental sustainability goals while maintaining sound investment principles. The impact portfolio is constructed using the same philosophical foundation you've come to expect from Vista: broad diversification, low cost, disciplined rebalancing, and an emphasis on those parts of the global stock market offering higher expected returns. The focus of today's conversation, of course, is how the impact portfolio can minimize or exclude ownership of companies ranking poorly on environmental sustainability measures while favoring companies with higher sustainability scores. And to help us better understand some of the important considerations and the methodology behind the impact portfolio, I'm joined today by Dimensional Fund Advisors Head of Responsible Investment, Joseph Chi. Joe has a long and impressive resume at Dimensional. He's formerly the chair of Dimensional's Investment Committee. He's a member of the Stewardship Committee, and he's previously a portfolio manager. Prior to joining Dimensional in 2005, Joe was a securities and finance attorney specializing in venture capital and initial public offerings, IPOs. He earned his bachelor's degree and his master's in business from UCLA, as well as a Juris Doctorate from the University of Southern California, and he is also a chartered financial analyst. Joe, welcome, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Dougal. It's great to be here, and thank you to everyone for joining us today.
So, Joe, before we dive into environmental sustainability, could you take a few moments to tell us a little bit about Dimensional Fund Advisors and the investment philosophy that underpins your firm's approach?
Sure. So Dimensional has been around for almost 40 years now. I think that not only we have a very long track record in managing portfolios, both in the equity and fixed income space, the thing that really differentiates ourselves from our peers is our approach that we take, which is really hasn't changed in 40 years. And it's basically taking financial science and putting it into practice in live portfolios. That financial science tells us that first, markets work very well. That's why it's very hard to outperform market benchmarks. And that's because investors in a very competitive environment react very quickly to new information and incorporating the prices. So as a result, we do think material information is quickly reflected into prices. And that's why we use the information in market prices to think about what are ways to manage a portfolio that can increase the likelihood of outperformance in the long run. And we believe the best way to do that is to do it in a systematic way, a way that focuses on long-term drivers of expected return. And this is shown to be borne out not only by research, but also by our longer track record. These drivers of expected returns, I'm sure you've heard them before, their size, relative price, and profitability. If you can keep portfolios consistently focused on these types of characteristics, we do expect that you can outperform over longer periods of time. It's very important also that you take into account costs and diversification. Diversification is very important in helping to not only maintain costs, but also improve reliability of returns. So when you look at our portfolios, that's what you're going to see. You're going to see portfolios that are focused on smaller companies, deeper value companies, higher profitability companies, and very diversified and all managed with an eye to keeping costs low.
Well, thanks for that summary, Joe. That's much of what you said will ring familiar, of course, to our clients, those on the call today, as we've worked very closely with your team since 2005. And just to sort of put that partnership in perspective of the roughly $1.7 billion in assets we manage on behalf of clients, about half of that's invested via Dimensional mutual funds. The other half, of course, is invested in Vanguard index funds and ETFs. So, along with the folks at Vanguard, Dimensional, you and your team have played a huge role in our success and have been an incredible partner in our client success for many, many years. So I'd be remiss if I didn't thank you and your team for that. And of course, for joining us today. So let's start with some of the basics of climate change and environmental sustainability. Before we do that, I do want to acknowledge for those listening that there are a lot of buzzwords and acronyms flying around out there relative to green investing, SRI investing, ESG. That's a big one in the investment community right now. And just to define some of these terms, E in ESG stands for environment, S for social, G for governance. These often get lumped together, you know, for better or worse. And while we strongly believe that our clients benefit from good corporate governance and engagement, that's the G in ESG, we feel that we get that thanks to Dimensional and Vanguard's direct engagement with companies on important matters to shareholders, which are ultimately our clients. And so while there are some very important issues being screened in socially responsible funds as well, that's the S in ESG, what we're talking about here today is really moving the needle with respect to the environment and aligning investors' portfolios with those sustainability values. So I know that's a lot, but hopefully that sets the table for a conversation today. And so Joe, I want to turn back to you. You recently co-authored a paper, really informative paper titled The Economics of Climate Change. And while this topic generally has become politicized, certainly recently, and at times has been hotly debated, can you share with us a bit about where there's perhaps the most agreement and perhaps disagreement amongst both climate scientists and economists?
Absolutely. Yeah, so I definitely agree, Dougal. It's a very important issue. It has, unfortunately, often been influenced by politics. It's something that we want to subscribe to. Our approach has been to look at the research, to talk to the scientists, to better understand really objectively what's happening with climate change. And when you think about climate change, there's usually a few big questions that people ask. One is, how do we know it's happening? How do we know what's causing it? And in fact, if it is happening and being caused by what we think it is, how do we know that we as humans are responsible for it? And so in speaking with leading climate scientists, we've talked to the folks over at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography a number of times, and they're amongst the top three in the world in terms of research funding for climate science. Look, there's no real disagreement among scientists that the world is warming. Over the past, we'll say, since the industrial era started, we've probably warmed about a degree, just over a degree. And that's important to know because even a single degree makes a big difference in other things. For instance, when you think about wildfires or very extreme weather events or global warming in terms of flooding and things like that. So we know very confidently that the Earth is getting warmer. The next question is, how do we know or what's causing it? And what's causing it is really the increased level of carbon or equivalent greenhouse gases in the environment. This is something they've been measuring over decades using the same methodology, and they find it very consistent across different parts of the world. So there's also quite a bit of agreement in terms of what is causing the warming. By putting greenhouse gases in the environment, it creates a greenhouse effect, keeps and retains heat at the Earth's level. And so as long as we continue to emit, we can expect that the Earth will continue to warm. Question then is, okay, well, how do we know it's anthropogenic activity it's causing? How do we know humans are causing this? And really, there are many ways you can look at it. Ever since the Earth was around, there have been natural causes for greenhouse gas emissions. For instance, if you have methane trapped in the polar ice, if it melts, it gets exposed to the environment. If volcanoes explode, you have also greenhouse gases, things like that. But once you control for that, once you control for all this natural activity, it's clear that really the vast majority of greenhouse gases is being caused by human activity. So that's really the first part of that paper, Dougal, just to talk about, is the Earth warming and what's causing it? I think there's wide consensus among scientists that it is being caused primarily by human activity. So that in itself sounds not so good. People generally associate climate warming as not a good phenomena, and emissions get blamed for that. But it's also important to realize that emissions have played a vital role in the progress of mankind. Without emissions, we wouldn't be able to feed as many people as we do. You know, I think that our progress has been able to reduce a lot of the starvation, particularly in third world countries. It's helped increase but developments in healthcare, technology, advances in education. Many of the world's problems, of which many are still unsolved, have been benefited by the use of emissions to advance our ability to provide for the needs of our people. So people should realize there's a trade-off. Emissions in themselves, you know, will cause global warming, but they also lead to better outcomes for us and for future generations. The real question, though, is can we continue to do this? And there's reasons to believe that we can do it in a way that will make sense. And what I mean by that is we are able to accomplish more and more with less and less emissions. So we're being more efficient about it. And so that does give us some hope. At the same time, we recognize we are progressing down a path right now, which is clearly going to result in significant warming beyond what scientists have considered to be a tipping point, so to speak. So we'll need a lot of work to get there. I think everyone has a part to play. But that's really the way to think about it is, okay, emissions, if done correctly, actually are not so bad if we can still meet our goals in terms of advancing progress while not resulting in tipping points. So how do you do that? Well, you really have to influence behavior. And therein lies one of the biggest challenges with sustainability is the idea of externalities. People that emit benefit from those emissions. If I use my air conditioner, I get a nicer environment to you know, live or work or play in. But those emissions obviously have an impact on today's climate as well as the future climate for future generations. So there's an externality involved for people that emit is that they don't bear the full costs of the cost of emissions. And the next question is, well, what is that cost? It's very hard to assess that cost because the impact of greenhouse gases goes decades or centuries. And so when you think about adding up the cost generation over generation, you have to apply a discount rate that can be very sensitive. If you change the discount rate by 1% or 2%, the number you get from a cost of emissions can be changed by five times. It can be $50 a ton or $250 a ton. And that's a huge, huge range, which you can imagine there's not so much agreement on just because of the assumptions that are made. Now, that's one challenge. The other challenge is really aligning incentives here. You know, how can, even if we said it was $200 a ton, how do we make the person that's emitting pay that? And that's something I think that if governments were to step in and impose a carbon tax or a cap and trade system, that certainly could be part of an answer. There are other global coordination issues in that if one government decides to act better, it doesn't mean that all other governments will necessarily cooperate. So it's a very, very challenging issue, but it's one that we think is important for people to think about because it does influence our day-to-day behavior. And last but not least, and most impressing question for investors is, okay, well, so now that I understand some of the background on climate change and how to think about it economically, how does it impact me as an investor? You know, first of all, is it already incorporated in asset prices? And the paper shows that we do believe it is incorporated in asset prices. In other words, if companies are exposed to higher risk, then their valuations reflect that. If they are exposed to or better positioned for opportunities to benefit from climate change, for instance, they can develop technology, then I think valuations reflect that too. That shouldn't be surprising because, as I mentioned in my first response, we think the market does a very good job taking into account material information. Climate risk is clearly a material risk. It has risks and opportunities for different companies. And so we do think investors have been taking that into account for many years. So that's really a summation of the paper, and it's posted on SSRN for anyone that would like to read it.
Well, that's a fantastic summary and an overview of the issues. And with regard to that paper, we do have a copy of that and that we can make available to clients upon request, of course, and folks can use the internet to find it on SSRN, as you mentioned. So I appreciate you laying that out for us, Joe. I think certainly Vista, we're in agreement that investors not only want a high probability of meeting their personal financial goals, but many want to balance these environmental trade-offs that you mentioned, and having a good portfolio while also doing good by the environment, you might say. So let's turn maybe specifically and talk about how Dimensional approaches sustainable investing, how its approach may differ from other fund providers out there, and maybe a little bit about how the approach has evolved over time. After all, you led the launch of Dimensional Sustainable Strategies more than a decade ago. So I'd be curious as your thoughts on the evolution of those strategies.
Sure. It seems just like yesterday, Dougal, but it has been over 12 years now, 12 and a half years since we launched our first sustainability strategy. That was in I think April of 2008. The background on that really was that we had been asked for several years before then to launch a sustainability strategy. And so we did start looking at what that meant. For us, it meant making sure that if we were going to do something, it was going to have to satisfy, first and foremost, a good, robust investment solution, and also the desire to incorporate sustainability considerations. It wasn't just going to do the latter. Because what we saw in the marketplace back then, and even a lot now, is really a lot of products out there that we don't believe are very good investment solutions. They are very concentrated. They're completely excluding several sectors, most likely energy, utilities, and materials, are high fees. And not surprisingly, if you look at their long-term track records, they haven't done very well. And to us, we didn't want to put out a product that wasn't going to have expectation of good long-term expected returns. So when we thought about the issue, we thought about from several standpoints. One was, can we do sustainability and have long-term expected returns that are higher than the market? And the way to do it was to really incorporate it into our core strategy framework, one that was very diversified, one that focused on size, value, and profitability. At the time, we didn't have profitability, but later on, we incorporated it because we felt that this was one way where you can incorporate exclusions or underweightings due to sustainability considerations while maintaining it inside a very diversified investment solution that was focused on long-term drivers of expected returns. Now, then the question was, okay, so you can do that, and our approach of having a core solution actually set us up very well for that. Then the question was, how do you define what is a good company, and then how do you incorporate that? Well, it's interesting. On first thought, people might think they know what is a good company, but when you actually think about it, it's not very easy to define for it's a good company. It's probably easier to come up with examples of what you think a bad company is in terms of sustainability, but it's very hard. And the reality is that it's really a continuum. There are bad companies and then there are better companies. And that's really the way we thought people should think about it, and that led us to putting together a scoring approach where we would score companies on sustainability characteristics. Now, what you use for that score is up to you. And we'll talk about how that evolved over time. But the idea is if you have a score, then you can actually rank securities and then you can use that to help weight securities. Now, this actually may not seem that novel nowadays because many of the index providers are doing this. At the time, it wasn't the way things were done. In fact, we got a patent for it, which I think really validates that we were pioneers in this kind of approach, using a scoring system to set up a methodology where you could then incorporate specific ESG or SRI goals in a portfolio. And that's what we did. And it allowed us to really maintain diversification while accomplishing these goals. Now, I mentioned before that what you put into the score can vary. And at the time we started with 13 different variables. All of them seem intuitively helpful when you think about sustainability. Things like carbon emissions, think about land use, recycling, reporting, compliance reporting, things like that. And after the first 8 years, what we had told investors really came true, that the results from the standpoint of performance were pretty much spot on with our non-sustainability counterparts. We really felt that the drivers of return would be driven by size, value, and profitability, not by the exclusions, not by the underweightings that we did. And that was very much validating what we had said ex ante. But the other comment that we got, though, was while they were happy with the returns, they couldn't quite figure out what was going on in the portfolio from a ESG standpoint or sustainability standpoint. They saw what we purported to use, the 13 different characteristics, but you know, it was very hard to unpack that when you looked at, you know, a weighting of 1% in the fund of a particular security. How did we get there? And when we thought about it, it was pretty obvious. They were right. If you try to use too many things, you're not going to be able to really show anything in terms of what you're doing, because in a diversified, you know, a portfolio, it all gets sort of aggregated together. So at that time, in around 2016, we went back to the climate scientists and we said, you know, what really matters in terms of climate change? And without you know, missing a beat, they basically said it's one thing. It's really greenhouse gas emissions. That is the most important thing. So we revamped the scoring to focus heavily on greenhouse gas emissions. And today, that scoring is 85% based on carbon emissions intensity. There's a few other considerations too, land use and biodiversity, toxic waste, water management, and things like that. But by and large, the vast majority of our scoring is focused on carbon emissions. Now, what's also good about that is carbon emissions are pretty objectively reportable, at least the ones we use. So not only were we able to focus more on what we believe to be the most relevant criteria, we were able to also provide reports to investors to show them how much of a reduction their portfolio had in exposure to the highest emitting companies. We did one more thing at the time, Dougal. We also added a screen for fossil fuel reserves. And that's because if you just look at emissions, you'd probably still end up with a lot of companies that you scratch your head at and say, why am I holding this company? It's a large energy company that we know is associated with climate change. And the reality is energy companies don't have that much in terms of emissions, certainly not with respect to utilities, which have the most. But they have fossil fuel reserves. These are reserves in the ground that at some point will enable future emissions. And that's why people have an issue with these kinds of companies when they're looking to lower the exposure. So we added a screen for that and we report on those. I think we have some information on that as well for this webinar. And that really could help investors understand how much reduction they were having in terms of both emissions and reserves. So that was a change we made in 2016, I believe, and it's been very well received.
Well, that's an important point. I appreciate that. There are so much information out there, so many variables, lots of metrics, and there can, and some of these reporting metrics, you can see wide divergence in what, you know, some people define to be a good company or a bad company. So it's refreshing to hear you say that Dimensional's focus squarely on greenhouse gas emissions, you know, focus on what matters most. And the primary goal, of course, of these strategies, which we're utilizing in the impact portfolio, is reducing those without sacrificing these sound investment principles. You touched on some of the other considerations with respect to, you know, palm oil and coal. Can you touch on those briefly?
Sure, and we didn't enumerate those, but coal is also excluded. Now, coal would have been excluded for fossil fuel reserves for the most part anyway, but in case it wasn't, there are other uses of coal. The reason we exclude coal separately, this is outside the scoring that we talked about, is because of all the fossil fuels out there, coal is the worst one when it comes to energy efficiency. It has the most emissions per unit of energy generated. It also has very bad health impacts from the standpoint of black carbon and particulate matter. This is not something that's associated with emissions per se, but we know that coal emissions really have a very bad impact on human health. So we exclude that. Palm oil is another exclusion. It's not a big exclusion when you think about the whole universe, but there are companies involved with palm oil. And the reason we exclude palm oil is because a lot of the operations for palm oil are associated with deforestation. How is that linked back to sustainability? Well, forests are one of the two biggest natural carbon sinks. Next to the ocean is the forests, and that helps take carbon out of the atmosphere. So when you remove forests by deforestation, then that practice is not considered to be a positive sustainability practice. It has a very negative impact on overall climate change.
Thank you for that. I want to ask one more question about this, just so I'm clear and all of our listeners are clear, and then we'll dive into maybe some slides that can kind of lift the hood on this portfolio that we're talking about. And so Dimensional is gathering data on company emissions, direct emissions of CO2, other greenhouse gases, as well as the reserves, the potential to produce emissions down the road. How is that data reported? You mentioned that you get pretty reliable data now at the corporate level. How is that measured? And once it's measured, how is it applied in real life portfolios?
So we use a number of data sources, and I may probably back up, just talk a little bit about how we measure GHG, greenhouse gas emissions. You can measure it using different scopes. So scope one is the most narrow. You can use scope two, scope three, scope four. Scope one measures a company's direct emissions. So if you have a company car and you drive it, and it has emissions, not an electric vehicle, that is considered scope one emissions. If you have a company, a cafeteria, and you're using methane and cooking, you're burning gas, that can be emissions as well. Your HVAC, you know, these are all sources of emissions that are direct. Scope two, though, is probably more prevalent for most companies. And scope two is indirect emissions from the usage of energy. We all, you know, unless we have a grid ourselves, you know, we're using electricity to power our HVAC, our lights, our computers, and, you know, we're using electricity. And that electricity has to be generated somewhere by utility. That utility is burning coal or oil or gas. Maybe they have nuclear or other renewable sources, but it depends on the region and the utility that you have. So that is considered scope two. Even though you're not burning and causing emissions directly, by your use of energy, you are causing emissions. And that's a very broadly accepted measurement of emissions. Scope one and scope two are generally used. There's a lot of people talking about scope three. Scope three is really upstream and downstream, your supply chain and your product line. So how much emissions did it take to produce the inventory and supplies that you are buying from somebody else? And how much is it going to take for you, or how much is it going to cause once you sell your product and distribute it by the end consumer? You can imagine that's not an elementary exercise there. It's a very challenging exercise trying to calculate scope three. We do think it's helpful for companies to do this. It's good for companies to know sort of where their emissions profile is. But when you want to measure that accurately across thousands of companies, you know, you're not going to get a very reliable result. Now, scope one and scope two, because of the Carbon Disclosure Project, which has been around for a couple decades now, you know, that's relatively developed, and quite a few companies do self-report. It's not required, but they do self-report their emissions, and more companies have been doing so. For companies that don't report, the larger data vendors, ISS and MSCI and Trucost, many of them have models which they use to proxy scope one and scope two based on the kind of business and revenues that the company has. What we do at Dimensional, though, and you know that we spend a lot of time on data. Data is really somewhere I think we have been, you know, we've been working with data, large sets of data for almost 40 years now. We've taken all that expertise and applied it to our ESG and sustainability data. What we do is we actually will buy multiple sets of data from different vendors and compare them. And where we see large discrepancies, we go back to the vendors and ask them to resolve it, because we really want to get the best data possible. So long story short is we use a lot of different sources. We spend a lot of time validating the data and asking questions, because if you're going to design a strategy based on data, you want to make sure your data is good. So hopefully that explains how we think about data and how we use it.
Yeah, that's a great summary. I appreciate that. So if I were to say that back to you, I would say that, you know, Dimensional and the impact portfolio by extension is focused squarely on the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions using, you know, scope one, scope two emissions, and then applying a patented scoring system to exclude some of the worst polluters while underweighting and overweighting other companies to maintain a broad diversification and sound investment principles. So I want to pull up a slide here to help folks visualize what we're talking about. Now, Joe, I know you're not a portfolio manager anymore, so I'm not going to put you on the spot too much with this, but I might ask you to talk a little bit about this scoring system with this particular strategy as a backdrop. So what we're comparing here in dark green is the U.S. Sustainable Core Fund. This is a live publicly traded mutual fund, a dimensional strategy, comparing it to the Russell 3000 Index, which is a good broad measure of the entire U.S. stock market.
Absolutely. And this is an intended result. So what we've done here, as you said, we've ranked companies in five buckets from the least sustainable from the right-hand side to the most sustainable on the left-hand side. And you recall that carbon emissions is 85% of that scoring. We really wanted to underweight or exclude the worst companies, which is why you see this 2% versus 11% on the right-hand side. You know, it's a very meaningful reduction there in terms of companies that are considered to be the least sustainable. And as you then progress from right to left, you'll see that the most sustainable bucket is at 20% weight in the portfolio versus 13% weight for the benchmark. And this is something that is a portfolio-wide thing that you see reported here, but it also happens, you know, within each sector. So if I were to pull up other sectors, you would see a similar result.
Yeah, so let's take a look here. If I can change the slide. So here's the energy sector. You know, I imagine some people on the call are saying, well, the scoring system, they're probably all in energy. They're all in industrials and materials. But the reality is those sectors are not necessarily excluded from portfolios. And what we want is to still have a diversified portfolio across all industries. And that's, I think, what we see here.
Exactly. So you'll see different levels of weightings, say reductions. Here you see for energy, the two things are, yes, one, we still have energy. We have not excluded energy. And that's important to think about because not all energy companies, I mean, they all have emissions, they all have reserves probably, but not all companies are quote unquote bad. You know, we use energy, we all use energy. And many of these companies are actually developing R&D for renewable energy and other ways to produce energy in a much more efficient manner. You know, they're all aware of what's going on. So what we're trying to accomplish here is a reduction in the emissions and excluding the worst companies, but recognizing that energy companies, if you were to look at the best energy company out there, it still wouldn't fare very well against the best or worst financial company or worst healthcare company. That's not really comparing apples to apples. You do want to be diversified. You do want to hold energy. You do want to hold utilities, but you want to hold the best ones.
That's a great point. I want to tab one slide forward here. Look at this is the same fund, same benchmark, but looking at the utility sector. And for those of you on the call who are rolling your eyes and worried that we're going to go through every single sector, we're not. But one thing that really jumped out at me when reviewing the sector weights is that there's actually 0% of the portfolio in both the bottom two quintiles here, the bottom 20%, least sustainable and less sustainable buckets. So maybe explain for folks and help me understand what makes the utility sector so much less attractive from a sustainability standpoint than compared to, say, the energy sector, which I think you get a lot of headline news about.
Yeah, it's interesting. People talk about big oil, but they're less likely to complain about, PG&E. The reality is if you look at the emissions profile of utilities versus energy, it's way worse. It's an order of magnitude worse for utilities in terms of their amount of carbon emitted per dollar of sales. So we're talking 10 times worse in most cases. So that being the fact, if you really want to reduce emissions, you're going to have to hit utilities a bit harder. And it's not something that we intentionally did. We just looked at who the worst emitters are. Lo and behold, they were utilities. And that's why you see a much more dramatic reduction here in the bottom two buckets. And that's really what's going to get you to the result you see later on, which is a meaningful reduction in overall emissions intensity.
That's great. Thank you. Joe, you've given us a ton of information here. I'm going to give you a little bit of a break while I introduce kind of peel back the or lift the hood on the actual impact portfolio that we're talking about. So this impact portfolio, this is our name for this roll-up of funds and strategies that we can build for clients today. We believe this sits really at the intersection of where sound investment principles and minimizing environmental impact really meet. So what we're looking at here on this slide is a comparison of the company stock exposure. So this is not including bonds, but the stock exposure, stock side of a typical portfolio. Clients should be familiar with this, a snapshot that really closely resembles how we manage portfolios today. And you can see some of these comparisons. So they're very similar from an investment standpoint, similar expense ratios. That's the portfolio's weighted average cost, of course, charged by Vanguard and Dimensional to manage these strategies. They're both very well diversified with over 10,000 individual company stocks. Now, some people might look at this at the 10,000 stocks and say, well, that's a lot less than 15,000. Maybe this is not as well diversified as what I have currently with the optimal portfolio. I would say while that is true, I think for comparison purposes, we can look at some of these global market ETFs. You know, Vanguard, for example, manages a great basic total world stock market ETF, great one-stop shop solution for accessing global stocks. It's got about 8,000 stocks in it. So even with some of the sustainable exclusions that we're talking about and maybe a little less exposure to the smallest stocks in emerging markets, we still have very broad coverage, and I think can feel very good about meeting the test of diversification. Now, on this graphic, there are a few other considerations that are important to us when we construct portfolios, and those are primarily the split between U.S. stocks and international stocks, the weight of large companies in the portfolio versus small company stocks, as well as the division between higher priced growth stocks and lower priced value stocks. So these are things that clients of Vista have heard us talk about for a long, long time. And as we can see, these two portfolios are quite similar in each of these in this regard. And then at the bottom, of course, we can look at some of the weighted average price to earnings and price to book ratios, measures of course, what we're paying on average for a dollar of earnings or a share of the company's net assets in these portfolios. And so I think we can look at this and feel good that we're not making really any investment sacrifices. Now, most of you are probably asking, you know, I tuned into this call to hear about the impact. So I want to turn to that. While we feel very confident this portfolio meets our demands for a well-constructed portfolio, what's really important is how are we really moving the needle? Are we improving our carbon footprint? And that's what this slide, I think, attempts to illustrate. And this, to me, Joe, is really the payoff of everything we've discussed. All the screening, all the scoring, all the data integration is the ultimate reduction in emissions. And there are two comparisons here that I want to highlight. The one on the left is talking about emissions intensity. This is the amount of the weighted average emissions of a company per $1 million of sales. That's the metric that's used. And you can see that the impact portfolio is reducing that intensity by about 70%, which I think is a very meaningful reduction. And then, of course, on the right is the reduction, as you talked about, Joe, in potential emissions, which is from fossil fuel reserves. And that's, I think, a massive reduction. So some might ask with respect to the scope one and the scope two and the 70% reduction, you know, some people might be asking, well, why isn't it more? Can't we get rid of all of it? So Joe, I guess I'd turn that question to you.
Sure, Dougal. And the answer is it would be very hard to get to 100% on the left side. This is the emissions intensity. And the simple answer is that companies have emissions. Very few companies have true net zero emissions. I mean, we all, like I said, use energy, for instance. So, you know, if you don't use energy, then yeah, you might have zero emissions. But 70% is a very, very meaningful number when you think about the fact that we all have emissions. Getting to zero or even 90% reduction would be a very challenging exercise. And if you were to do it, most likely what it means is you're going to sacrifice a lot of diversification. You might go much closer to the kinds of other funds that we talked about earlier, which are very highly concentrated funds that we don't think represent a very good investment approach. So this is an approach that I can't take credit for, but one of our other clients referred to as fossil fuel smart. It's not fossil fuel free, it's fossil fuel smart because it takes into account trade-offs, and yet it does achieve a very meaningful reduction in emissions. So that's the 70% there. And then, Dugo, I lost the screen share there. I'm not sure if you're seeing it still.
Let me, yep, that was my fault. Let me pull that back up here.
Okay, yeah, so that's the left side. On the right side, well, why are we able to get to 100% emissions? Well, a reduction in potential emissions. Well, here we're talking about a fairly limited set of companies that have fossil fuel reserves. Most companies don't have fossil fuel reserves. So here the trade-off is not so hard to make. You're able to pretty much exclude all reserves without really sacrificing a lot of diversification.
Great, thank you. I wanna just get to a couple more questions. I see we're close to running out of time. This has been a fascinating discussion. So just got a few minutes left. Joe, what question here, excuse me. How does this portfolio address maybe some of the social concerns around alcohol, tobacco, or firearms?
Well, it doesn't have an alcohol screen. Alcohol is certainly an issue for some investors from a social standpoint. This is a environmental sustainability portfolio, and so there is no screen for alcohol. It does screen for tobacco. You might say, well, how does that relate to environmental sustainability? We tend to take a little bit broader definition of sustainability. The UN defines sustainability as meeting the needs of the current generation without compromising the ability to meet future generations' needs. Tobacco, we know, well-documented impact on human lifespan. So for us, that means a very direct impact on current generation sustainability. So that is a difference between, say, tobacco and alcohol. Civilian firearms, well, you know, certainly no need to talk about all the unfortunate tragedies that have happened. You know, really, one use of firearms is going to be to reduce human lifespan. And that's something that I think is, it's not a big exclusion. I should also mention these are not really too relevant from the standpoint of materiality, but we're able to incorporate them because, as I said before, we start with a very diversified portfolio. We can do that without impacting what we expect to be the expected return of the portfolios.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you. So a couple of the questions that I'm seeing here relate to questions from clients on what does this mean for me? How does this impact me? How can I adjust my portfolio transition in this direction? And I just would like to say a couple things on that. One is, you know, some clients have owned these funds for over a decade. The reason why we're able to do this now, we think in a broader solution, is thanks in large part to Dimensional and some of the work you've done in bringing these funds to market and allow us to build a really globally diversified portfolio that we feel really good about. For folks who want to transition to this, there may, of course, be individual tax considerations and switching from one fund to another. And so we really need to work directly with you, with your client team at Vista, to analyze some of those trade-offs, costs, taxes, and what that ultimate impact is, and decide on what the right transition for you is. So feel free to reach out to your team at Vista to have that conversation, one that we look forward to having. One last question I want to address, which I think is important, certainly in a real personal financial standpoint, is someone asked, how would transitioning to the impact portfolio affect my financial plan? As many folks know, we have one of the deepest benches of financial planners in Oregon at Vista, and a huge part of our work is building sustainable portfolios from a longevity standpoint, to make sure they meet folks' income needs, aspirational wealth needs, inheritance needs, so on and so forth. We don't anticipate that the impact portfolio will have any material change on any of the financial planning that we have done for anyone. the primary building block in any portfolio for a retiree or someone who's looking to retire and draw income from their portfolio is, of course, that mix between stocks and bonds, low cost, diversification, things like that, all of which are part and parcel to all the portfolios we manage, whether that's the impact portfolio or not. So in closing, I would just like to say we think we have developed and built in partnership with Vanguard and Dimensional a solution that really helps balance the trade-offs between good investing and doing good. I think we perhaps need to be a little bit realistic or modest about what this actually accomplishes. After all, we are dealing with stocks, and if we sell them, someone else is buying them. The reality is, as Joe, you mentioned, governments probably have the biggest role to play in this. They can implement carbon taxes and cap and trade systems. Corporations can decide what they produce, how they're going to go about producing it. And consumers, of course, can demand sustainable products and services from those companies and take their business elsewhere. I think what we're talking about here is that investors, too, can have their preferences and their desires to leave less of a carbon footprint and leave a planet, a more sustainable planet for the next generation, that they can make those preferences known via the portfolios they hold without sacrificing long-term returns. So I wanna thank you, Joe, for your time today, everyone for your questions. Thank you to all the Vista clients who attended. We appreciate, of course, your trust and confidence. And the last thing that I want to pull up here on the screen, just to give you a little bit of a teaser, is we have developed a white paper that describes much of what we have discussed today and shares some of what that impact is. And if you are interested in learning more about the impact portfolio, please reach out to your team, your lead advisor, your advisor at Vista, and we can get you a copy of the impact portfolio to help start having some of these fun conversations. I'm a little bit over time. I apologize. Joe, I can't thank you enough. Thanks to your entire team, your work at Dimensional on our behalf and our client success. And thank you specifically for your time today. This has been a lot of fun.
Well, you're welcome, Dougal. And really, the pleasure is ours. We very much appreciate the long-term partnership and happy to be here.
All right. Have a good day, everybody. Stay safe. Stay healthy. Thank you.